Hello, and welcome to the very first Strand Group podcast. I'm Martin Stolliday, the manager of the Strand Group at King's College London, and your host. The Strand Group at King's College London is a group devoted to learning about the hidden wiring of British government. We teach, research, and put on events devoted to understanding the way government works through looking at contemporary history. And now we've decided to launch a podcast. Why? Well, the flippant answer is because everyone else is doing one. The more serious answer is that we wanted to bring some of the fun, the anecdotes, the gossip, and a deeper understanding of government to a wider audience. And, listener, we wanted to bring you our unique mix of practitioner and academic, something that's a hallmark of our teaching and events. So, without any further ado, our first episode is devoted to the Blair and Brown governments, 1997 to 2010. Just so happens that our guest today have been writing and teaching about Blair and Brown since, well, it would probably embarrass them to say. Those guests are Professor John Davis, Director of the Strand Group, and John Rentoul, the Independent's Chief Political Commentator. Together, they wrote the acclaimed book, Heroes or Villains, The Blair Government Reconsidered, and they were both series consultants on the recent BBC Two documentary, Blair and Brown, The New Labour Revolution. We'll also hear some clips from our recent event at King's College London, where the two Johns were joined by a director from the documentary, Liz Merman, alongside contributor Ed Balls. Hi, John Davis. Thank you for being here.
Good morning to you, Martin.
And hello to you, John Rentoul. Thank you very much for joining me.
Hi there.
John Davis, I'll come to you first. Could you describe the process of being a series consultant on this series that we've all enjoyed so much? What did you do and how did it come about?
Thank you, Martin. Yes, well, it was like a wonderful bonus. It's been like a lovely coda. I mean, when you write a book, and I've not written many, John Rentoul, JR as we call him, has certainly written a lot more than me. But once you've written a book and you tour it and, you know, comes out in paperback, there's not really much more that you can actually do with it. But what's happened with this is that 2.5 years after our book first arrived, it's sort of like got a new lease of life, and it's all through this BBC documentary. What happened was that our book, long in gestation, I think that JR will agree with me, it was all about polishing the diamond, and it took a long time. It took a decade, let's be honest, between signing the contract and it coming out. But it in many respects, and we got lots of excuses why, and some of them are good. What was particularly interesting about it is that when it did finally arrive in 2019, in March of 2019, it certainly seems to us now, and maybe this is a bit self-serving, that we'd kind of marked maybe like the moment the tide turned in terms of that horrible phenomenon of Blair hate. And so when we published our book, we got really nothing but like warm words. I mean, it's nice when people think that what you've written's good, you know, like in terms of the way it reads and it's interesting. But in terms of the actual material, I think that, you know, it's probably the first book in about a decade and a half that was even remotely pro-Blair. And so when the book arrived in the spring of 2019, we were really very pleasantly surprised by its reception. And in the August of 2019, I received an email from the BBC saying that they'd recently read the book. This was the same team that had put together the BAFTA-nominated series on Thatcher, documentaries on Margaret Thatcher. Really good documentaries, really good. Like different, you sort of like look at it and feel this is fresh. This is the state of the art. And what they did is they contacted us and said that they were thinking they've been such a success, the Thatcher years docs, that the BBC were thinking they hadn't commissioned it yet, but that they liked the gist of our book. Could we meet? After about 3 or 4 months of quite a few conversations, they asked us to be the series consultants.
Fantastic. The Thatcher documentary was just brilliant, wasn't it? It was such a fresh take on what we sort of all thought we already knew, but it did seem completely new and revolutionary at the time. John Rentoul, I've enjoyed the documentary series immensely, especially looking back at those remarkable years. Is any of what Blair and Brown did in those years still relevant? Is there anything those in government can learn from this era, or is it just nice to look back?
No, it's still relevant. You can tell by the huge resonance it's had. I mean, it, that series keeps on being referred to by politicians and commentators today because there are so many themes that still seem to be relevant. I mean, not least the great relationship between a prime minister and a chancellor who wants his job. I mean, obviously, Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak are very different creatures, but the same basic power dynamic is still there, and people refer to it. And Conservative MPs could constantly talk about, that Blair and Brown documentary, drawing analogies about, the fact that ministers were sacked in those days who wouldn't be sacked today. All these issues just keep boiling back, and the way the documentary handled them, I think, was just brilliant because it's a different way of doing a documentary. It's just to do interviews and archive footage and to stitch them together in a really sort of intelligent way without any commentary. So it allows the people to speak, it allows the pictures to remind us of what it was like at the time. And it allows the viewer to make up their own mind. So, a lot of people went away thinking, Tony Blair was awful, Gordon Brown was a giant, and a lot of other people thought the opposite. And that's the genius of a really good documentary, I think.
JR, can I just follow that up? Because for the first time, when you're mentioning that, the actual construction of that documentary, it's not dissimilar to the way we put together our book. Now, one of the things about our book is that, I grew up under Peter Hennessy over at Queen Mary, the doyen of contemporary history. And one of the things about Peter, most people love his writing, but a few people, and I remember Paddy Ashdown, was it Paddy? No, it's in Paddy Ashdown's diaries. I think it was Derry Irving. Talking to Paddy Ashdown, saying he didn't like Peter's style. And what he was referring to were these huge quotations, which is very much Peter's style. And the idea being that, again, but in prose, you let the actual practitioners speak for themselves. Metaphorically, you hear their voices rather than a very clear steer from the author his or herself. And so I think that the one of the reasons why the BBC were maybe interested in what we did is because it actually resonated with what they had in mind for the documentaries to come.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember thinking, that was the thinking behind our book, was that we had, we had so much material of these people who'd come to our class and spoken. And obviously, they'd been asked questions by us and our students as well. But, the whole point of those classes was to allow them to speak and to give them time and space to set out how they saw it. I mean, obviously, you can criticise it afterwards and comment on it. And we did that in the book as well. But the TV series, in a way, just sort of condenses that in a format which allows people then to talk about it and criticize it and disagree with the protagonists.
And you both teach and have taught on our module, The Blair Years, at King's College London with our colleague Dr. Michelle Clement, and that's very much that approach too, which is we get the guests in and we let them talk about their time. How do you as teachers and as writers about these years make sure that what doesn't happen is that those who come in indulge in score settling or setting the record straight with how they want it? Is there a way you have to steer through that potential minefield?
Oh, we like them score settling. That's always interesting. And actually, I mean, yes, but there is a problem there. You're right, Martin. And we did see that in the TV series because certainly someone like Tony Blair, who is a consummate performer, has got down to a fine art a number of his accounts of what happened that reflect well on him. And yes, we obviously have this constant tension in our classes as to how do we bring the other point of view to our students' attention. And you know, in the TV series, they did that by including William Haig and Michael Howard and Diane Abbott.
Claire Short.
Yeah, I mean, not huge. Didn't give them a huge amount of time, but just a signal that there were other points of view. And I think that is the way to do it. But you're quite right. You've got to be on the guard for the fact that these are the sort of polished reflections of some quite sort of accomplished people, accomplished at presenting their side of events.
I think that there's a really interesting element to this as well, that as we now, it's clear for all to see through these documentaries and many other things, that the real opposition to the... So it's not like that there was a government line and they're trying to settle scores. It's that actually the opposition was within government. And this wonderful idea that, you know, when Margaret Thatcher, wasn't it, who spoke about the oxygen of publicity, she was referring to Sinn Féin, I think. But this idea that to be an opposition, you need oxygen, you need media attention. And as William Haig, has spoken about, and I think Michael Howard too, during those Blair Brown years, the official opposition with a capital O actually couldn't get media attention. And so the real opposition is between number 10 and number 11, between the Prime Minister's office and the Treasury. And so when the scores are being settled in our classroom, they're actually intra-government scores. And so I think, first of all, this makes it actually much more complex and much more interesting. But secondly, we do certainly try to balance up the Blairites and the Brownites in the guests that we actually bring.
Now we can hear from two of the speakers at our recent event. Firstly, Liz Mermin, director of episode 2, discussing the Blair-Brown dynamic, and Ed Balls talking about the process of being interviewed for the documentary and his views.
And I think, a few things that are important to know when you're watching the series. This is, I believe, the first time that they've sat down together, and not that they were together, they were very far apart, but have been in the same program. The way we were able to intercut them and their views has not been done before, and we did not know until the very last minute whether we were going to have both of them at all. So we directors all came on board, we had to plan how we would make this film if we didn't have either of them. So, I mean, we had the model of the Thatcher series, where obviously Thatcher was no longer around, and so you can do these films without either of them, but we kind of knew that it would be better. And so we, poor Ed was subjected to, I don't know how many hours of interviews. We had to really cover our bases in case we didn't get Gordon or Tony. So we had all these...
That's why. Right? That's why there were so many hours.
Well, I mean, you would have been speaking in his stead. No,
the Sunday Times about a week or so ago said that multiple sources had told them that it was Gordon. It was Gordon who was
reluctant.
No comment.
Well, Blair had to. They couldn't say yes right away because Blair's a big, important person, and how would it look to just say yes to the BBC right away? So they strung us along a little bit. But I mean, he was wonderful, and he let we all interviewed him, and he gave us lots of time. And I personally was extremely disarmed by him. I think we all were preparing to be rather more critical. He was delightful, incredibly charming and modest, and thoughtful and. And Gordon, I didn't meet, but he had many, 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 probably most conversations. Well, Ed was having quite a few conversations with him, I think, and Steve was talking to him all the time, and he went up to Scotland many times. And then just as he'd said yes, finally, because the other thing, of course, that happened to us was coronavirus, so we were about to start filming when we went into the first lockdown and everything had to stop, and we were all sort of sent our separate ways and told to come back when and if we were allowed to, and then we started up again in the summer, and then I think Brown wanted to go at the end, so when he was finishing his book, and so we had a date in December, and we were at that point finishing our edits, because we'd done everyone else in August and September, but it was still possible, and then we went into the second lockdown. And at which point we kind of, you know, I mean, there are budgets and money and schedules and all that, and they had run out. We were supposed to be done with the series, and we didn't have Gordon, and he had said he would do it. So everything had to stop, and all of us directors, being freelancers, went off to do other projects, except, you know, and eventually Steve did get Gordon, but he did get a phone call in Scotland the night before he was supposed to do it, saying that he had changed his mind. And wonderful Steve talked him around. And he was given all of our questions, and he interviewed him for everybody. And, you know, it completely transformed the series, obviously, because suddenly when you have those two voices, then all these other wonderful voices who we had are tampered, you know, they get sort of, you know, they have to be... You have to make way for them. They're just so strong. Even though they're both, you know, Blair is a wonderful performer and Gordon is very guarded, there is something about the way they talked about their relationship, and that's really what you look at in episode 3, which is, I think, gripping.
First of all, in terms of doing it, I did 11 hours of interview over 4 different days. And I think that was fairly common, talking to Angie, Alistair. They did the same. And in the old days, when we were in government, we'd have arrived with a press officer, fully negotiated deal, no of those lingering shots before and after. Somebody would have recorded it. And we didn't do it that way. We just turned up. And I think the biggest emotion I had watching the film, I was talking to Angie last week, exactly the same. She said, I watched the whole film thinking, what did I say in those interviews? And are they about to use it? And but the interesting thing is, we all, I think, ended up feeling very relieved about the very honest, open, fair way in which the film had been made. It's an interesting thing, contemporary history. How do you move from journalism to contemporary history? And in some ways, it's the point where, you know, there is not yet every source and every book and every paper, but it's the point where people feel able to reflect. And I think if you look, you know, across all the interviews, I mean, I think I've had the great advantage with John of doing now 7 years of the Treasury class since 1945, every Friday, and we spent our whole time reflecting upon all of these years. I'm not sure that everybody in the films was yet quite at open reflection phase. And the challenge for these guys is to make a piece of contemporary history when they have some of those challenges. And it's interesting when people do these hours of interviews, you see the sort of different kind of personality traits coming through. Gordon, bit grumpy, not hugely reflective. Tony Blair, I mean, he wasn't just Jonathan Powell and Alistair Campbell. Tony himself described himself as messianic during the films. And you see quite a lot of those messianic moments emerging. I think one of the really interesting things, I mean, if Gordon hadn't done it, it would have been because he didn't want to make a programme which made it about personalities. That was what he was always worried about. It should be about ideas rather than about personalities. But, of course, the prism of this relationship is such a fabulous personality story. And I think one of the challenges is that the personality story can be a bit excluding. So, you know, I watched it thinking, I can't believe they didn't have Neil Kinnock, 1985, Bournemouth, as part of the birth of New Labour. Now, I can't believe that John Smith is such a minor footnote in history, when if it hadn't been for his tragic death, he would have been the next Labour Prime Minister in 1997. To me, it was kind of quite striking. Harriet Harman, who was, you know, as instrumental in some ways, as Peter Mandelson in the kind of the politics of New Labour wasn't in there. But that's partly because of this personality prism. But on the other hand, it's an amazing story. And you start off with the two of them in their room. And you end, when Gordon finally leaves Downing Street in 2010, with, you know, Sue and me and Ed Miliband and Alistair Campbell and Andrew Donis in the room, Peter as well. And actually, you sort of see that there was, you know, those personalities, it's actually more than just two people. There was actually a commonality. If you'd done the Blair years, it wouldn't have been the same as the New Labour years. And at that point when Stuart Wood says it felt like a New Labour wake, you couldn't have captured that without the both of them. And in a way, I think the thing I feel when I look at this, when you look back, and of course it's nostalgic, and to see all of these pictures, you actually do see there was, you know, in their social democratic impulse, a great commonality between Blair and Brown in this project. You know, there was a coming together, which in personal terms, as I say in the film, sticks much, much tighter than people understand. You know, when Tony Blair was deciding to stand down, it was Gordon he rang privately for advice on the words he should use to announce his departure. And it is Alistair and Peter who are with us on the day Gordon walks out to resign from Downing Street. So there's a personal continuity which belies some of the mythology. I'm not saying that there weren't big bust-ups. There were big bust-ups. But there was a depth of personal relationship which outlasts the Tony Blair premiership. But also, look, political parties are coalitions. I mean, that's the nature of a two-party system. Labour's always been a coalition which had to reach, you know, from working-class industrial trade union Labour through to metropolitan intellectual Labour. And Tony Blair and Gordon Brown were the duo who managed that synthesis. And, you know, within that, there were different emphases. And the reality is, you know, when Peter Mandelson says, which you can interpret, you know, Peter's playing some games here. Tony was more New. Gordon was more Labour. Peter was more Labour. Alistair was more Labour. We were all more Labour. Tony was always pulling against that Labourness. But the Blair-Brown divide, you know, the groups, wasn't a Brownite Labour versus Blairite New. There was actually far... And that is why you end up with Alistair and Peter in the room at the end of the period.
And now, back to my interview with John Rentoul and John Davis.
I think there's a third tribe there as well, isn't there, John, which is the government official
who are...
And that's something that you've brought in your collaboration with John Rentoul. John Rentoul obviously has, as you like to tell our students, New Labour on speed dial, but you've tried to bring in some of those other people. Can you talk about that process of getting those in government involved in trying to analyse those years and maybe how their perceptions of the Blair government have changed over time?
Absolutely. Now, you know, there's no false modesty here. This is all standing on the shoulders of Peter Hennessy. Now, what Peter, I mean, all that we've done really is sort of like taken his approach and just expanded it. Now, what he would do is he would tell us that it's all very well understanding the politicians of government, but that's not the full story at all. If you really want to even get, you know, like get close, and nobody ever really understands British government, that's certainly my contention, because it's just too fluid, it's too organic, it's constantly changing and evolving. What I think is interesting is that a lot of people over decades and centuries have often tried to explain British government, even to themselves, by just understanding the political element. Whereas actually, you've got to understand the civil service side too. Now, these civil servants who, you know, in Hennessy's great phrase, enjoy the thrill of non-recognition. These people are difficult often to tease out of the shadows. But I think that one of the reasons why we have such involvement with the civil service, past and present, is because We're trying to get it right. We truly are trying to understand the pressures, the powers, the opposition of events that go to make up a history of a government. And this is where, you know, when you've got, you know, in our book, you've got people like Nick McPherson, not in the documentaries, but you've got people, you know, like the late Jeremy Haywood, people like, you know, one of the standout stars, I think, of the documentaries is Sir Richard Wilson, as was Lord Wilson of Dinton. You know, just extraordinary, these brains, and a very different point of view.
Sorry,
Richard Wilson is the, yeah, he really was a star, you know, a wonderful, wonderful commentary on New Labour offered from his unique position as cabinet secretary. But actually, I think the most important thing that we did in the books, and perhaps this didn't come across in the TV series, is to cut against the yes minister thick of it cliche about how, you know, the civil servants are sort of doing the real job and they're manipulating the politicians. I mean, what we found in our interviews and our research is that an awful lot of the civil servants actually felt that the New Labour government was a good government. They enjoyed working for it. They enjoyed working for many of its ministers who were good, strong ministers who knew what they wanted and could make decisions. And they actually found it liberating to have a fresh reforming government that actually wanted to change the country. And they were part of the project, even though, you know, obviously they maintained their political impartiality.
It's such an interesting point you make, JR, because as you know, I mean, we in the first, let's say, 10 years from 97 on to about 07, the prevailing idea was that the civil service had been downtrodden by the Blair government, both Blair and Brown. There was some evidence for some particular personality clashes. And, you know, what often happens, as we see throughout history, that when a new government comes in, some of those who towards the end of their careers, you know, they are either seen as too stuck in their ways or too identified with the outgoing crew, or indeed, you know, are not really, you know, very modernise-y. Not a word, and I'm sure that you'll take me to task over that, JR. But I think it's really interesting how, on several occasions, and the big one that comes to my mind, JR, would be Sir David Normington, who actually, you know, wanted to come to our class to really refute that theory, and to say that the best years of his life, over many years, hard years, were the delivery-focused years of New Labour, where there was a Prime Minister who knew exactly what he wanted and was driving reform, and a Chancellor who had plenty of money, knew what he wanted, and was driving reform himself. Added into the mix all kinds of other very interesting, powerful people like Michael Barber and Andrew Adonis, and, you know, a whole plethora of very, very impressive people. And so that whole idea of the politicisation of the attacks on the civil service, I hope that we've gone some way to exploding that myth.
I think there's also a point there, John, isn't there? Both Johns, really. That I think a lot of the initial tension was because a lot of very capable people came into government, not on the political side. So you had Alistair Campbell and Ed Balls, and these huge figures came in, and maybe you guys have written the book, but maybe the machine didn't quite know how to take that at first.
Well, I think you'd say that they were political, wouldn't you? You'd say they're political, but they're not as politicians.
They're not politicians, yeah.
That's right. I mean, that's one thing the documentary did capture very well, was the shock of the Treasury official side when Ed Balls arrived. I mean, you know, they were expecting Gordon to arrive, but what they got was Ed Balls with a letter that he'd already drafted for the governor of the Bank of England, and that I think that yes, there was a culture shock, wasn't there? There was an established official machinery that took some time to adjust to uh, to this influx of new talent, new ideas, and quite capable people.
And John Davis, that's something that really comes out in the book and in the documentary. There's a kind of slightly counterfactual role of the Treasury in those early days. It's counterfactual in the sense there's a common accusation that Blair's first term was a wasted first term. New Labour didn't know what to do in government. Talk to us a little bit about how the role of the Treasury in those early years counteracts that idea.
Well, yeah, I mean that's a theory that, you know, like I think it's one of those that helped Tony Blair to frame his argument in his A Journey book. This idea of a wasted first term. Come on, Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, House of Lords reform, minimum wage, freedom of information. What am I missing out, JR? Human rights legislation. Come on. You know, like this idea of a wasted first term. What it is he's saying that I think that it's not a wasted time. It was, as somebody said to me the other day, really clever this, I thought, that what you had was 10 years of learning on the job from Blair. Until so, like, by the end, he's amazing. But I think that the first 3 years, at least, certainly up to 2010, that's where he's trying, as a barrister trained by Derry Irvine, to drill down into the absolute guts of ideas. And he's talking about, like, things like, I'm going to get to your Treasury point in a minute, Mark, but that point about drilling down into how the NHS, one of the most complex systems humankind has ever created, how it actually works. And by about 2000, Blair is getting to that point where he understands it. So when he's saying he wasted his time, what he's saying is he'd really like to have been prime minister for 3 years before he became prime minister, right? Doesn't make sense. So when we're looking at the Treasury, I mean, look, that's one area where they had plans. They had deep plans. And so Bank of England that you've mentioned, you know, when Ed Balls came in with that letter, the Treasury thought, oh, yeah, here comes Ed Balls. We've spoken to him a lot. He did an internship in, I think it was 1990, 1989 in the Treasury. Oh, he thinks he understands everything, does he? Let's have a look at this letter. They look at the letter and they go, there's not much needs changing here. Because it was on the money. It was brilliant. And as JR was saying, what you've got here is not just SPADs, special advisors, political advisors coming in. You've got highest caliber ones. Some of the highest caliber special advisors ever seen in British government, ever. You know, I would have thought, you know, like, just sort of like off the top of my head, in the top 10 most powerful special advisors ever in British government, you might get five from New Labour. It's an incredible influx of incredible talent. Now, when it comes to the Treasury, you've got the Bank of England. We're just mentioning the minimum wage, which was, look, once upon a time, that was the stuff of real political controversy. That if you impose a minimum wage, I mean, I've just been reading Duncan Weldon's book on 200 years of muddling through the British economy. Wonderful stuff. Looking at, you know, this idea of classical economics, that if you get involved in wages, then all kinds of horrors, including high and consistent structural unemployment, will follow from it. I mean, a New Labour did it. So that nowadays, this is not an uncontroversial thing. In fact, the Tory party under Osborne grabs it and goes, oh, we're going to expand it. And this is the way forward. But yeah, it was an incredible time. And as time goes on and the emotions start to fall and we start to move to a phase of historiographical reassessment, I think it's fair to say that we are going to see that New Labour is... not just as Ed Balls put it in the documentary, which has been debated in the weeks afterwards in places like the New Statesman, that New Labour was the most redistributive government since 1945. I think that that's been proved in most senses. But also the fact is what they did. They came in a hurry, and by God, did they do a lot.
Not sure at the time, John, if Tony Blair or Gordon Brown would be very happy to be described as the most redistributive government since 1945.
They certainly wouldn't. They certainly wouldn't. But they are better on this than me.
No, They were divided on that, weren't they? I mean, Tony Blair in particular didn't want to go on about it because he thought that would scare the Daily Mail reading classes. But I think they were both genuinely committed to that redistribution and were proud of it. I don't think there's any question about that. There is the interesting question of whether the Treasury kept up its reforming zeal. I wonder if you could argue that Tony Blair became more sort of innovative and more imaginative and creative about policy over his 10 years, and Gordon Brown became less imaginative and creative. And by the time Gordon Brown took over, he was completely exhausted and the cupboard was bare.
I think that that's a very strong theory there, JR. I think that in our book, we look at the, you know, like getting to the guts of the Treasury. When we've got the current Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, Sir Dave Ramsden, who was the Chief Economic Advisor during the latter part of the Blair years, talking about did the Treasury, you know, talking about the Treasury, did we the Treasury actually keep our eye on the day job? Because there's a really interesting point about how the Treasury were getting involved in reviews across all things. From student finance to regional infrastructure to, you know, all kinds of stuff. They were into everything, including the big pensions reforms. Very much into the hospital foundation, the foundation hospitals agenda. They were into everything. And as JR, you know, puts it, you know, when you look at it. They were, if you had a spectrum between conservative and radical, you could say that just about every time they were on the more conservative side than Blair. What Ed Balls would very forcefully say is that did, even, you know, like whether you can argue that all that you like, but he would always say, no one's more New Labour than me. I was New Labour all the way through, and as Ed Balls puts it, in the 2010 leadership election after Brown had resigned, Ed Balls was the only one who said, I am proudly New Labour. So there's a very interesting point here, and I think that it goes back to when Peter Mandelson in the documentaries, and I can see this as an essay title, can't you, JR? When he says, look, when you think about New Labour, it became clearer over time that Tony was New and Gordon was Labour.
Yeah. Oh, the wonderful thing about the documentary is it's full of lines like that that would give us titles for exam questions for the future. But there were also a number of things that a lot of people have said after the documentary that it missed out. And I wonder if how many of those were important absences. One thing a lot of people have mentioned is, I mean, this is right at the end, was Gordon Brown in the 2010 election campaign when he was confronted by Gillian Duffy over immigration. Do we think they should have included that?
I think yes. Yeah. I think it's one of the big moments. Certainly, if you're talking like Martin, one of Martin's initial questions was, what's the resonance to now? And I think that clearly immigration is going to be one of the big issues as time goes on over, you know, where New Labour were on it. You know, you can look at that 2004 and go, oh, wow, 2004 is the moment. But then actually we're talking about it was in advance of months rather than years, you know, in terms of allowing free movement to the new accession countries of the East. But also, there's, you know, there's all kinds of geopolitical issues on that one as well, right? You know, when it comes to they were the countries who had supported the coalition of the willing over Iraq.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not saying that this is all good. I'm just saying it's so much more complicated.
Well, what we're saying, I think, is that it should have been a 10 episode documentary.
10 at least. who's the guy in America? Caro, isn't it? With all of his huge books. You know, that's what it needed to be. Basically, it could have just been like a coronation street. Just carrying on half an hour every week.
Well, yeah, but what we've got to do, John, is get hold of the get hold of the full interviews. I understand Ed Balls did 10 hours. Well, he ended up with maybe, what, 10 minutes on screen?
Yeah, they were good 10 minutes though, weren't they?
They were very good 10 minutes, but we've got to get a hold of those original full length interviews and make use of them, because I think
you used to work at the BBC, JR. You know where they lock these things away. You probably still got your password probably still works over there.
Well, I did notice there were one or two bits of footage in the documentaries that I was responsible for shooting when I used to work at the BBC. So. Yes, when I was following John Smith around, trying to ask him awkward questions about one member, one vote, I remember some of that footage.
AJR, them were the days.
We've only just had a Labour conference when they've been debating, you know, leadership, rule changes. So these things are, as Peter Hennessy would say, hardy perennials, aren't they? They come back and back and back again.
Don't let Martin get onto the constitution of the Labour Party. It's one of his favourite topics.
I wish I understood it. No, you're right. I think the easy to watch it from a knowing point of view, watch the documentary and say, oh, this is missing and that is missing. I actually think the genius of it is to make it so accessible that anybody can watch those documentaries and really get a feel for the time. I mean,
yeah.
One of the things I noticed was there was none of the sort of liberal interventionism that we teach, Kosovo and Blair's, the wars prior to Iraq. But actually, if you put that in, what do you leave out? You'd probably have to leave out Northern Ireland if you were going to do that. So it's very tricky to make these things. I think the team who did it really well. Can we discuss Peter Mandelson? He's the self-titled third man, and watching the documentaries, he's so important in those early years. And yet once they get into government, it's hard for him to carve out a role, and there are resignations, and it all gets a bit sort of difficult for Peter. Even though, as Richard Wilson says, he was an incredibly able, one of the most able ministers. John Rental, what happened with Peter Mandelson?
Well, I mean, that's what was marvellous about the TV documentary is that it captured the personal level relationship so well. I mean, on Blair and Brown, you know, it managed to capture that relationship by the dint of interviewing them separately and then cutting them together so that it looked as if they were almost talking to each other. And you could almost sort of sense that Gordon Brown just refused to engage all the time, whereas Tony Blair was sort of open and cheerful and upbeat and actually quite respectful towards Gordon in a way that Gordon completely failed to reciprocate. But then, it also very faithfully, I thought, the series reflected Peter's role as the third man, as he describes himself, because he was, in a sense, he was the next most important person. I mean, although Alistair Campbell and Angie Hunter and others were very important. Peter Mandelson was a critical part of that sort of triangular relationship at the top. And of course, the most emotional moment in the series is when Peter Mandelson is responding to his second sacking. And, you know, he clearly hasn't got over that. And I don't think Tony Blair has got over it either, because, you know, Tony Blair sort of admitted that it was a mistake, that he shouldn't have done it. But he did, because he thought he had to be ruthless and, you know, he just had to sort of shut himself off from the emotional connection and just do what was in the interests of the government. Now, obviously we can argue until the end of time as to whether that was the right decision. I mean, I suspect he could have got away with not sacking him. But it was, you know, you could see how it was touch and go at the time. And, you know, then the TV documentary does the wonderful trick of having Peter Mandelson come back, you know, very late in the day, you know, brought back as Gordon Brown's sort of symbol of Blairite intent, you know, that he's actually going to be New Labour again. And we see Peter Mandelson with his remarkable pullover and suit combination back into Downing Street.
I think when it comes to Peter, it's I find him endlessly fascinating. There was a wonderful documentary, you can probably, I think, you can get it on YouTube, called that followed Peter Mandelson in the last year of the Labour government in 2009, 2010. It's called Peter Mandelson : The Real PM? Now, if you're fascinated as I am, watch that, and you get the mannerisms, you get the you get the brain, you get the incredible brain. I think he's one of the most clever. I think he's one of the cleverest politicians in British government for the last 30 or 40 years. But what I think is the really interesting point here on Mandelson. And why in breaking down, and it's touching, you know, when he's saying everything for my party, everything for my party. I believe him. I don't always believe everything he's saying, because he is the master of getting across messages in different ways and whatever. But in terms of that, I believe him. And I believe that that's, you know, the thing that is on his heart, across his heart, Labour. Now he may very well define that in a different way to many others, but for him, Labour is everything. But he was attracting, and he does kind of hint at this in the documentaries. He was attracting a lot of difficult attention from the media and from the wider public. He did have very high tastes. Hey, he's got every right to, but from a Labour point of view, from a Labour, from Tory tabloids, they were having great sport with him, you know, being seen at all the right salons in London, and, you know, the reveling in the idea of the Prince of Darkness, I can understand Blair now dispassionately looking back and going, look, you know, like, should I have got rid of him? No. But actually, at the time, I think it felt quite different. And I just got a little point to make about that. Blair famously said that his job in the... You'll have the direct quote, JR, in your brain somewhere. But Blair famously said that his job will be complete when the Labour Party learn to love Peter Mandelson. I think right now, the most recent Labour conference apart, with the "Where's Peter Mandelson" jibe to Starmer, I think actually Peter Mandelson could say the same about Tony Blair, that the Labour Party modernisation would be complete when the Labour Party learns to love Tony Blair again.
Well, indeed. I mean, that's what Andrew Adonis said in our class, wasn't it? That Labour won't be elected again. Unless it learns to love Tony Blair. I mean, and there's an element of truth in that. I mean, the Labour Party has to come to terms with its most successful leader, and I think that's another message that came through so strongly in the TV documentary. I think was it just reminded people of what a successful Labour government looked like, and it made them realise that, you know, Ed Miliband and Jeremy Corbyn weren't it, and obviously uncomfortably raised the question of whether Keir Starmer is anywhere near that as well, and I think, you know, that's why the TV series had such an impact.
Thank you so much. That's terrific. Another question for you, having watched the documentaries, you both know all these characters quite well, and so not much would have been a surprise. But are there any surprise stars from the series that come out to you? Is there anyone you watching your documentaries, you thought, oh, that person comes over really well, you know, the unknown? For me, I think Tom Kelly comes over brilliantly when he's talking about Northern Ireland.
Tom Kelly, yeah. I mean, Tom Kelly, when I was reporting on the Labour government, he was just a press officer. He was a civil service press officer. You know, he was very good. He was very competent, but he was very straight. I didn't realize that there was quite such a depth of understanding of what New Labour is about, and in particular, you know, his depth of understanding of the Northern Irish peace process, which I should have realized. You know, he knew all about, but you know, he was able to articulate that on television in a way which was unexpected, because he wasn't one of the public faces of
no.
the
No, no, like, I think that the Tom Kelly sections for me are the best of the entire series. Talking about being Northern Ireland, you know, I grew up in London in the 1980s and 1990s, and the bomb threats when I was first at work. You know, I would say 1 in 10 days I was late for work because of real or hoax bombs. This was real. And the way that Tom Kelly spoke about news just in was never good news, and the death and destruction that was going on the streets of our country was, I thought it was a stain on our hearts. You know, I know this sounds all really deep, but that's the way I felt. And the way that Kelly brings it across, I think, is remarkable. I think he rose to the level of events. And I think that what he does, especially when he speaks at the end and says, you know, how he did his daughter going into the centre of Belfast, it's wonderful that she doesn't have to face this. And how a whole generation of Northern Irish children have grown up not having to face this. And if there was one thing that I was really keen on this series really getting across, is Blair's brilliance. Blair's, you know, we talk, you know, they joke about, was he the Messiah or was he effing Jesus Christ and all this sort of stuff. These ain't bad comparisons, are they? Right? When it comes to Northern Ireland, when he walks into Alistair Campbell one Monday morning and says, I know how to do Ireland, right? And he goes, what? You know, and Richard Wilson's eyebrows raising, you know, above his head, eh? And you know what? He went and did it. And he did it where Gladstone couldn't.
Yeah.
And John, he gave himself a year. I mean...
Yeah.
It was not only was it hard, he gave himself a year in which to complete it.
It was just bonkers ambition. And he pulled it off. I mean, it's the one thing that, you know, I mean, over years and years of dealing with the phenomenon known as Blair Rage, the one thing that always works is I just have to say, what about Northern Ireland? And people just suddenly stop ranting and change their tune and say, well, yes.
Even Jeremy Corbyn gave it, didn't he? You know, yeah. I'd give you Northern Ireland. But yeah. Apart from that...
Yeah, exactly. But one other person who I thought who was an unexpected star in the documentary was Patricia Hewitt, who, you know, previously had always struck me as a very much a sort of on-message robot, Secretary of State. I mean, she was very good. She was very competent, and she did a good job. But I thought her sort of barely concealed viciousness towards Gordon Brown was just a revelation that she was prepared to go on TV and say that, you know, to describe his totally unreasonable behaviour in cabinet meetings. Just generally stick the knife in. That was most enjoyable.
Another one, JR, I think, was Angie Hunter.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's a really interesting point, this, that when we think of New Labour, it wasn't very heavily female-dominated at the top, not by a long way. And I think that one of the challenges that the documentary makers had was not to sort of like bring a false narrative here to say that there were women at the very top making the very biggest decisions with the, as Angie put it, the stags, you know, rutting. Yeah. And also the fact that two very senior Labour women who undoubtedly would have been stars of the show in Mo Molam and Tessa Jowell have sadly passed.
Yeah.
What it did is it allowed, as JR was saying there, some voices that may have been overpowered previously to actually come through. Now, we know Angie Hunter from our classes, and you know, she's a force of nature, I would say. And when she comes to the classes, and others, Sally Morgan too, one that they didn't use was Baroness Jay, who would have been very good. But what you get there is it is a very different angle. And I think that Angie was wonderful. Can you just imagine, you know, when her, you know, I don't want to say it, but, oh, the stag's rutting. Imagine her being in the middle of it and just going, come on, boys. You know, put your toys away. You can just hear her saying it, can't you? And defusing a situation and getting her point across. Although I understand that in the House of Lords, one of the lines that's going round at the moment is the phrase, do keep it plausible, darling, after Angie's immortal words to Blair, after his Women's Institute disaster, where she said to him, well, I thought that went quite well.
It's wonderful, isn't it? We just mentioned Patricia Hewitt and her disdain for Gordon Brown. We know the camps still exist and the tensions are still there. After watching the documentaries, your books, one side be happier than the other? Are the Brownites feeling in the ascendancy, or are the Blairites feeling that they've come out of this on top?
Well, that's what I thought was one of the triumphs of the series, was that it managed to strike that balance. Because, I mean, that's the problem that John and I also had, is, you know, are we doing, you know, in the Blair years class and in our book, you know, are we doing the Tony Blair story, or are we doing the New Labour story, which is inevitably what Tony Blair once called the 10 plus 3, which is, you know, 10 years of him, followed by 3 years of something slightly different that sort of tailed off and ended in electoral failure. And, you know, I thought the documentary did that well. I mean, they only gave the Gordon Brown's government half of one episode, so that's a tenth of the whole thing. And yet, you know, obviously he was there throughout, and you know, his presence was very much felt. And if he hadn't agreed to give that interview to the series, it would have been a very different program, because, I mean, then it would have relied extremely heavily on Ed Balls to carry the sort of Brownite argument. And actually, Ed Balls, I think, as he made clear in the documentary, does have some differences with Gordon Brown, and does think that Gordon Brown didn't handle his side of the coalition totally perfectly. So yeah, I thought it was fair enough. I mean, I think there are some Blairites I've spoken to who are not, who thought that Gordon Brown got too much of an easy ride in the documentary. But I mean, I think that just reflects the fact that its technique, which was to allow the people to make their own case, and then the viewers can make up their minds.
My sense is that, first of all, I read in the Sunday Times last week from multiple sources, so they claim, that Gordon was very late to the interview, that lots had been completed before Gordon, late in the day, decided to accept an interview. It would have been a very different, and I think a lesser documentary series if Gordon hadn't have done that. Now, my sense is, and on the opposite side to JR, no. On the same side, I've heard both sides, that the Blairites are a little bit, there are some Blairites who are a little bit edgy. Nobody's unhappy, as far as I can tell. Just a little bit, you know, not perfect. Too much to Gordon, as JR says. You know, didn't question him on some of his points, where he says, you know, like, oh, I never really wanted, you know, I never pushed for the job.
Never agitated for it.
Yeah, come on, look. It's just not true. And that maybe that needed, you know, a bit more unpicking. At the same time, I thought Blair was excellent, as always, as JR says, you know, very practiced. But at the same time, I think gave a little bit more emotion, even though he says that he doesn't like showing his emotions in public. But for me, whether you're talking about up or down, this is not a zero-sum game. I think that what it leaves, and I think that this is sort of like undeniable, I think that it leaves the history of the New Labour governments from an historiographical point of view, in a much stronger position. And I think that when JR and I first started out on this project, some 13 years ago now, because we just believed that the historiography of New Labour was historically wrong. If you think about a pendulum, it had gone far too far the other way. From those days of Blair being having 93% approval rating, whatever it was, you know, all the way through to it must have felt like to him 93% disapproval ratings by the end, that things had gone wrong. And that history was going to record the New Labour governments very differently, especially as Churchill would say, if we write the history.
Very good. John Davis and John Rentoul, many thanks indeed for joining us for this, the first and hopefully not last Strand Group podcast. I think anyone listening would agree that the bar has been set very high indeed. If you'd like to know more about the Strand Group, please join our event mailing list at thestrandgroup.kcl.ac.uk. And we hope to be back very soon with another podcast. In the meantime, I wish everyone, friend or foe, well. That's it.